Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's the story of how a man devoted to guy food, you know, steaks, barbecue, fries, navigated the bumpy road to healthy eating. John Hodgman is food and drinks columnist for Men's Journal magazine. He calls his story, Eat This or Die. Speaking of healthy eating, cookbook author Sally Schneider has a new technique for fast, healthy soups. On a global scale, Travel and Leisure magazine's Anya von Brimson reports on the new wave cooks of New Delhi, India. From Vancouver, novelist Timothy Taylor turns the idea of local food into a story of a chef, the homeless, and the forest primeval in his book called Stanley Park. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, one of the great joys of traveling the back roads of the Midwest is finding these little communities that have a really powerful ethnic identity. One of the best of them is Pella, Iowa, a Dutch ancestor town where you get not only Pella windows, which happen to be made there, but culinarily speaking, you get Pella bologna, unique to Pella, Iowa, and also Dutch letters, which are a kind of Dutch bakery treat, cookies formed in the shape of letters of the alphabet. They're really wonderful to munch on. It's a great kind of pretty, it doesn't really look Dutch, but it definitely looks Dutch ancestor.
It looks extremely Dutch during the tulip festival. It's sort of wall-to-wall tulips. But Pella was probably the only place in America that has bologna that I like. I think I grew up on, you know, your basic Wonder Bread, you know, with a slice of bologna. I mean, kind of, it was like prison food.
But I like Wonder Bread and bologna, but never mind.
But it's what my mother would put in my lunchbox, and it always had this kind of depressing smell about it when you opened the, what then was, you know, cut right wax paper. But Pella bologna is very spicy and just delicious.
Well, it looks different. I mean, if most of us who, like myself, who grew up thinking of bologna as something that comes in a little shrink wrap pack at the supermarket, will be surprised to find Pella bologna. It's actually made in a ring. It's a sausage, a summer sausage, in fact, made in a ring. You go into, for example, the Intveld meat market on the square in Pella, and there they have long sticks on which the rings of bologna are hung, and you buy a ring, pay for it by the pound, or you can actually get a sandwich made from it, and it's really wonderful because it is much spicier than that kind of pale pink supermarket bologna, but not hot and spicy. It's got a real kind of juicy, beefy flavor that makes a wonderful
it's
sandwich,
very
especially with Gouda cheese on it.
Okay, but can you buy it in other places other than where it's made?
There are a couple of restaurants in town that do have Pella bologna sandwiches on the menu. It's no big deal to them. It's just like hamburgers, hot dogs, tuna salad, and bologna sandwiches. If you didn't know that you were in Pella, you would never think of ordering a bologna sandwich. It's a great idea to do so because what they do generally is heat up the bologna. So you get warm bologna, warm enough so that a nice slice of Gouda cheese will sort of semi-melt on top of it inside a nice hard roll. It's an excellent sandwich.
You can also find it in omelets in the cafes of the town, which it's kind of it's a Gouda and bologna omelet, but it's very delicious.
Plus, you can take rings of it to eat in the car for days afterwards, which is always a good idea.
What are the Dutch letters? Is that like a spice cookie or something?
They're a very
sort of like a butter cookie.
It's a very kind of mild tasting butter cookie. You'd want to have it with coffee in the afternoon, maybe. I don't know. I would have an M and an S with my coffee at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, perhaps.
Michael likes to eat his initials whenever possible. You know, I think obviously they're done with a piping bag, you know, filled with the cookie dough. And every letter of the alphabet is available, so you can kind of spell out whatever you want.
Are there other Dutch foods that, you know, the restaurants do?
We actually found one other. I don't really know if it's Dutch, but in many of the diners in and around Pella, you find an item on the menu called Dutch lettuce. This is a basic Midwestern salad, by which I mean, you know, iceberg lettuce, little radish, little carrot. But on top of it is this wonderful sort of warm, sweet and sour egg dressing and crumbled crisp pieces of bacon on top of that, with slices of hard-boiled egg. It's a real hearty salad, and it's called Dutch lettuce. Whether it's actually Dutch or not, I don't know.
Sounds good. Hey, guys,
it's very good. And, of course, for breakfast, no matter where you go in this vicinity, you must have cinnamon buns. Iowa cinnamon buns set the standard for the world.
Now we know. Thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I think we should give equal time to the other bologna. I know the Pella, Iowa bologna is very good, but there is this other bologna. It comes from Italy, and you could call it maybe the original. It is called mortadella. It comes from the city of Bologna in northern Italy. And when mortadella is good, it's creamy and faintly spicy, and it kind of melts in your mouth. Take cooked green beans, toss them in a skillet with some walnuts and little cubes of mortadella. They are dynamite. Sally Schneider is my kind of cook. She's worked out these brilliant strategies for cooking simple food that tastes good and at the same time is good for us. Now, Sally writes for national publications, and she's author of A New Way to Cook. Sally, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Sally, I want to talk to you about soups because, boy, this is the time of year. But I want to talk about soups that we can make after coming home from a day at work. And I think, a lot of people think you have to have homemade broth before you can make soup. So how do you deal with this?
You know, it's amazing how the idea of broth stymies a lot of people. The fact is that a lot of us don't have time to make homemade chicken broth anymore, myself included. And I have several strategies. First of all, I do keep commercial chicken broth on hand in my pantry, and I have many ways of doctoring it up and giving it powerful flavor very quickly. The first is I stockpile chicken bones from roasted chickens, whether it be rotisserie or one I've roasted myself. I keep them in a plastic bag in the freezer. If I want a chicken broth, I throw them into the commercial broth and cook it for about half an hour, and it will have a real chicken flavor. But barring having chicken bones, the other real miracle cure is a Parmesan rind, which I'm sure you know. After we've grated down the chunk of Parmesan to a nub, there's the rind, which is actually like a delicious bone that will infuse the soup with sort of beyond Parmesan flavor. The other bonus is I like to cut it up before I put it in to simmer because it will melt and become this wonderful, chewy, delicious bit in the soup itself. Now, I also love to infuse broths and a chicken broth with anything like whole garlic cloves, turns it instantly into a garlic broth, saffron, curry powder, that sort of thing. You infuse it just like tea, even wild mushrooms, till you get the strength you want, and then you pull out the spice or herb or whatever.
And that's a matter of minutes, right?
That's a matter of maybe 10 minutes to infuse at a simmer. Now, suppose I don't even have chicken broth. I like to make vegetable broths, but not the usual ones that are meant to mimic chicken broth, ones that are meant to have their own unique flavor from sweet, kind of aromatic vegetables like fennel, celery root, leeks, and peas. It is cut up vegetables, whichever one you want, leek or garlic or shallot that is going to kind of give you the aromatic flavor. Mm-hmm. And then I add a little cut up potato and a teaspoon of butter or extra virgin olive oil, because we need to give it the body that broths made with chicken or other animal products have, and it will do that.
Okay, so now some ideas for, I've got the broth, let's say. What
right.
can I make when I walk in the house after work?
Okay, well, what I want to be able to do is turn whatever I have in the fridge into something delicious. So I love to use leftovers. So I'll have my broth, and then I start to improvise with raw or cooked vegetables, roasted pumpkin, sauteed onion, grains, even like wild rice is delicious in a soup, cooked beans. I keep frozen pasta, filled pastas like tortellinis and raviolis because they're fabulous in brothy soups. Chicken pulled off the bone, little bits from a roasted pork, bits of ham, greens. You know, we have these wonderful bags of greens we can buy that keep for quite a while that are all washed. They just are put into the warm broth and will wilt instantly and give their flavor. Any herbs I might have on hand, a drizzle of olive oil, aged cheese, of course, like a grating of Parmesan. Even olives are fabulous in a soup. I once did a great soup with a celery root broth and white beans and olives.
Ooh.
It was just terrific.
So you don't need a lot, right? I mean, you just need some flavorful broth and then some kind of vegetable or leftover that you think you're going to like in it?
Absolutely. You could even open a can of beans and drain them. And if your broth has enough flavor, it's going to imbue them with flavor. And basically what we're thinking about is building in elements. It just has to do with what you have or what your whim is. The simplest can be some little raviolis in a garlic broth with a few shavings of Parmigiano. There's nothing better, especially if you're getting a cold. Or sautéed wild mushrooms, sautéed onions in a wild mushroom broth, for example. And I love to do something like a cheese toast alongside, which would be toasted garlic rubbed bread with a little cheese melted on it and maybe floated in the soup.
Sounds like supper to me. Sally, thanks.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. You can find her recipe for composed soups on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our new weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make midweek cooking a little easier. Each week there's a new recipe, my notes on some key techniques, and ideas for what to look for in the market right now. And best of all, guys, it's free, so you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Eat This or Die, One Man's Bumpy Road to Healthy Eating, What's New in New Delhi, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. SuperTarget believes in putting the fun back into food. It's a grocery store inside Target. To find a store near you, you can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. John Hodgman is food and drinks columnist for Men's Journal magazine. Now, this is a man who spends weeks researching, which means eating prime steak or home fries cooked in bacon fat or hot dogs so that he can write with deep understanding about them. He says his status as a fat ass, and that is his word, is a matter of public record. Well, then something changed for John. He wrote about it in the Men's Journal article called Eat This or Die. John Hodgman, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me about this article.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that that's the first line of the story was my status as a fat ass was a matter of public record. I'm not exactly sure what that means or where it would have been registered in the town hall. But, you know, when I got married not too long ago, some friends of mine put together a little video where they were talking about me and my life, and the references to the amount of bacon that I would eat just came up over and over and over again, including the very famous reference now that, you know, Hodgman is very selective. He will eat bacon, but he will not eat bacon off the floor, which is very flattering, but not true at all. I would have happily eaten bacon off the floor. I mean, I just saw it as a matter of being thrifty and also eating more bacon. So.
Makes sense to me, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And not surprisingly, when I went in for a regular checkup, my doctor sort of, well, took blood and then called me back, and there was a sort of dire note in her voice, and she said that I really ought to think about reducing my cholesterol. And she read off some numbers to me, which I jotted down. But the thing that I think really got her nervous was my triglyceride levels, which were pushing 700. And I called a physician friend of mine. I said, yeah, what does this mean, 688 triglyceride? And she was just, oh, my God.
This is a heart attack waiting to happen, isn't it?
I suppose it was a heart attack waiting to happen. Certainly, it did not look good. I am no longer a smoker, but I had been. I was overweight. My blood pressure was fine. But these cholesterol levels, and particularly the triglyceride levels, all do contribute to creating a profile that suggests that I would be susceptible to what they would call, I think, very nicely, a cardiac event at some point in my life. So, which is not something that I wanted to have happen. So, I said to my doctor, "Well, what should I do?" And she said, "Well, you should eat as close to vegetarian as possible." And I soon figured out that what that really meant was going vegan or vegan. So, my diet very quickly became fruits and vegetables almost exclusively.
How hard was it to eat this way?
Well, it was very difficult. I had to walk a lot farther to find a store that would sell me fresh vegetables. And then because I was so nervous about starving, I bought the heaviest vegetables I could find. You know, anything that had a lot of mass to it. I'm talking about turnips, obviously potatoes, beets, anything that would weigh down my backpack as much as possible, it seemed to me, would be the thing to go for. And then I brought all those home, and I roasted them in sort of absurd quantities, and I ate them, and I gorged myself. And, you know, to my surprise, I did not waste away. And it was also fun to lose a little weight, which kind of came off rather effortlessly, which had never really happened before. And I was very diligent, I have to say, because, you know, the way most people are when they start a diet, whether it's for health or for weight, you know, I really kept my intake of all fats very, very low. I think I probably had about 5 grams of saturated fat a day, and that would have been by accident. And so my guess was that by the time I went back to my doctor about 4 months later, that my blood would be as clear as a glacial spring. Well, there was some improvement, certainly. My cholesterol had come down. And the triglycerides had dropped dramatically from about 700 to about 200, which was a noticeable improvement. But the fact was that I was not in the age and behavior realm that they would suggest that I start taking a cholesterol-lowering drug. Mm-hmm. And so what it meant was that, you know, the good news was that my cholesterol responded to the what they call therapeutic lifestyle changes, and that's good. The bad news was that I would have to keep doing them for the rest of my life if I were going to keep it down. And that was not what I had signed on for. I had thoroughly thought that I would get it down to a level that would be so far below normal that they would be encouraging me to go out and have a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich as soon as possible. But in fact, that was not the message. And that was sort of a long and hard and hungry day when I found that out. So I had to sort of start again and think about what I was doing.
So now, do you eat bacon off the floor or not?
I do. I mean, to go back a little bit, I mean, the next step for me was to figure out why I wanted to eat cheese and butter and salt so much. And I started doing a little research, and I came across a guy named Rick Bell, who is a behavioral nutritionist at Tufts, and he also works for the Department of Defense. He's got this fascinating job. He devises all sorts of psychological strategies to get soldiers to eat everything they are served. And this ranges from seating soldiers with a senior officer who eats his whole meal, or sometimes they'll seat a very physically superb specimen of a guy next to the other soldiers, and he will eat, and the hope is that they will model their eating patterns after this guy. And it just blows my mind. I don't know whether I should be really worried or really excited that our government is spending money on these programs, but it's awesome, I think. And so he's really interested in how people eat and why people eat a certain way. And he started to talk to me about an idea that really made sense to me, which was this concept of food involvement. The sense that there are some people who are very food involved and some people who are not very food involved, which is to say that if you're very food involved, you believe that the decisions that you make about what you eat reflect your personality to some degree. They are an integral part of your life. And that was certainly the case for me. You know, I think that men are not, well, I should say, Rick Bell believes that men are not as food involved as women, and that may be so, but I think that men, when they are food involved, when they do think about food a lot, they're encouraged to think about food in a very different way from women. They're encouraged to like and cook and think about steaks, chops, ribs, you know, the trophies of the hunt that have been sort of the at least symbolic staples of the manly diet since as far back as we can recall. And I think that that had some effect on me as well. So I really had to get out of the meat and cheese rut and start thinking a little bit more consciously and curiously about all the foods that were available to me. And what I found was that there was some really fascinating, interesting, wonderful tasting stuff, but also stuff that just really made me very excited to find them, you know. Anyway, to answer your question, I do still eat bacon, but I don't eat bacon off the floor. And while that sounds like a joke, it's actually an important difference that I am much more conscious and curious about what I eat now than I was before, and a little bit more discriminating.
There's hope for all of us, John. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
John Hodgman is food and drink columnist for Men's Journal magazine. His article, Eat This or Die, appeared in the August 2002 issue. I'm Yvonne Brimson, writes about dining around the globe for Travel and Leisure magazine. She comes by the Splendid Table to share her adventures. She is just back from India, New Delhi, to be specific. Hey, Anya, welcome.
Great to be here, Lynn.
What is New Delhi like? What is the food scene like there?
Well, the food scene is so much more international than you can ever imagine. You know, for instance, when upper-class Delhiites want to go out, they'd go to a fancy hotel, and they would eat, you know, wood-burning pizza. They would eat, you know, the latest sort of French thing. You know, by and large, Indians, when they go out, they don't go for Indian food. And also, especially in Delhi and also in other big cities, you know, in sort of fancier but not really fancy restaurant, you have this trio of cuisines. Usually a menu would be Indian, continental, and Chinese. And that's something that we don't think of as finding in India, but there's a huge Chinese population since a long time in Calcutta. And Chinese and continental is part of, you know, a regular Indian repertoire.
Anya, how do you find the places you find to eat?
Well, it takes some sleuthing. In New Delhi, I was very lucky. I happened just to know a lot of people. and they're all fabulously helpful. I have a friend, for instance, called Ajit, and he was at the head of Citibank India, and he abandoned it all and dedicated himself to organic farming. So he's this visionary organic farmer that has a farm that's in a geodesic dome outside of Delhi. And he took me to a wonderful place called Quality. That's, you know, a very genteel sort of slightly colonial little coffee shop where we had chole botura, which is the big puffy breads that you use to scoop a chickpea curry. That's just phenomenal.
Well, who else?
Oh, then another person I met who's fascinating. His name is Rakesh Sethi. And he is a chef at the Oberoi Hotel, but he's also the Emerald Lagasse of India. He has a show called Mirch Masala, which means chili and spice, and the ladies just love him. They write him this wonderful letters, you know, and he basically, he's a very new breed of Indian chef, and he advocates fun, easy, healthy cooking. So if you watch his show, it's really not that different from what you're going to see on British or American TV. So in that way, I mean, it's a very kind of cosmopolitan, forward dining scene.
Now, you mentioned hotel food being where a lot of people go. Any favorites for you?
Well, one is a restaurant called Kandahar in the Oberoi Hotel in New Delhi, and that's where Rakesh Sethi works. And it serves kind of frontier food, which means, you know, lots of grills. But what they do is they get rid of the ghee, they get rid of the cream, so everything is just really transparent and light. And again, this is how Indians want to eat.
Uh-huh.
Another place that's fabulous in the hotel is in the Hotel Imperial. That's this lovely white Art Deco hotel that's been recently restored. And the restaurant there is called Spice Root. And it's unbelievably decorated. It took many years and God knows how many rupees. And it draws on all the cuisines of the Spice Route, you know, from Sri Lanka to Kerala to Thailand. And it's just a fun place to hang out, and the food is very nice.
What about nightlife in Delhi?
Nightlife in Delhi, if you talk to Delhiites, they, of course, will insist that, you know, there are a lot of things happening. Bombay is really the capital of nightlife. That's where you have a lot of freestanding nightclubs. And you have to remember, Bombay and Delhi had this traditional rivalry. And, for instance, Bombay is film. That's where Bollywood is. Delhi is fashion. The Bombayites think that Delhiites are very forward and aggressive. Delhiites, again, they go and hang out at nightclubs, at hotels, and restaurants and hotels. In Bombay, you have life goes on much later, and they go to sort of freestanding clubs. So, you know, they're always rivaling with each other.
Anya, thank you.
Pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen writes for Travel and Leisure magazine and is working on a new cookbook about the world's 100 best dishes. Now, you can find her list of New Delhi restaurants on the website splendidtable.org. Timothy Taylor is an award-winning Canadian writer. His satiric novel, Stanley Park, is the story of a young chef, Jeremy Papier. The press hails Jeremy as the new Alice Waters of Vancouver, a man devoted to local foods. Yet unknown to anyone, Jeremy is a walking financial disaster, maxing out his credit cards to keep his restaurant afloat. Well, as the story unfolds, the idea of local turns bizarre and provocative. Author Timothy Taylor joins us. Timothy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us about your main character. He's a chef. But could you read for us, give us a description of him?
Sure. This is a passage, actually, that sort of describes Jeremy's culinary worldview, if you like. What kind of attention was he attracting anyway? It was an important question Jeremy had long ago decided, because in the world of food you could be a Crip or a Blood, but you had to choose sides. One of the American students came up with these names at the Culinary Institute in Dijon, and they stuck. Crips versus Bloods. Crip cooks were critical. They fused. They strove for innovation. They were post-national. They called themselves artists. They tended to stack things like mahi-mahi and grilled eggplant in wobbly towers glued together with wasabi mayonnaise, and were frequently suspicious of butter. Blood cooks were respectful of tradition, nostalgic even, canonical, interested in the veracity of things culinary, linked to local by the inheritance or adoption of a culture, linked to a particular manner and place of being. Blood cooks liked sweetbreads and pot-au-feu. Bloods ate tacos, bratwurst, and borscht. They used lard and as much foie gras as they could get their hands on. They made cassoulet to the recipe left by Louis Casals. And depending on where the blood called home, they might like kimchi, salmon planked on cedar, fish stew with sausage or twice-cooked duck. Chef Jeremy Papier was blood.
Pretty philosophical.
Maybe more philosophical than cooks have time to be, but Jeremy's of that frame of mind.
Why did you choose a chef as your main character?
Well, I guess a couple reasons. I have a long-standing personal recreational interest in food. I cook every day at home. I go to the market every day. I mean, I've been interested in it for years. It was a natural thing, a natural bit of business for me to give a character. But more pertinently, I wanted to write a bit about how people feel about the place where they live and how they connect to the place where they live. And it seemed to me that food is an excellent language to describe these kinds of things. We say with our food, I think, a great many things about how we feel about where we live.
But Jeremy seems to have almost a, for lack of a better word, a death wish. He's striving to do local food, but he doesn't seem to be able to make a business work. So you didn't make it easy for him at all.
No, well, I mean, if you think about what is really popular and contemporary in cooking nowadays, it would be too easy just to make Jeremy have this interest in the local and succeed, because a great many restaurants, as we know, have done extremely well with this style of cooking. People are very interested by it. But that would be less interesting than if Jeremy had some challenges. And the primary challenge, I think, that he faces is that he's young, he's sort of ambitious, he wants to go forward probably faster than he can, and as a result he's not a good businessman. He simply doesn't plan things well, so he's, you might say, the author of his own misfortune.
Well, I don't want to give away the end of the book, but there's a play you keep going on through the book between Jeremy and his high-end food and the homeless. Could you tell us a bit about that contrast that you work?
Yeah, how this enters the story is that Jeremy's father is a somewhat eccentric anthropologist living in Stanley Park, researching a community of homeless people that live there in the forest. And over the course of the book, the professor, as he is known, advances the view that he and Jeremy are actually involved in parallel projects. Jeremy is exploring local through the use of local ingredients, local wines, by cooking in this way that he's chosen. But the professor is exploring local by looking at these people who are almost forced to be locked to one location by virtue of having no resources. Now, Jeremy rejects the professor's position. He doesn't feel that they're involved in similar projects at the outset. But as the book progresses and Jeremy is forced to compromise some of his culinary values, he sort of comes to see the professor's project in a new light.
Yes, he does. And you know, I think we should leave it there, because I don't want to ruin the end of the book for anyone. Timothy Taylor, thank you for joining us.
It was a real pleasure.
Timothy Taylor is the author of Stanley Park and Silent Cruise. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. It's about magic and food. Where can you find Italian farm children on the night of January the 16th? I know this is a little arcane, but I can't resist this stuff. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food. At SuperTarget, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve it up, all in one stop. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where can you find Italian farm children on the night of January the 16th? Now, I know this is odd, but stay with me. You can find them in haylofts. They hide there waiting for the miracle of the animals. Now, this is the eve of San Antonio's Day. Now, his picture is in every barn in Italy. He's always in brown robes, and at his feet is always this pretty little pink pig. Looks like the model for Babe. And the pig is always staring up into the saint's eyes with this adoring look on his face. You see, San Antonio is the patron saint of the pig. He's the pig's protector. And by extension, he protects all the farm animals. On the night of the 16th, he always performs the same miracle. He allows the animals to speak, in Italian, of course. Well, they sing, they carry on, and essentially, they have a party. Farm children huddle in haylofts waiting for the miracle. But they always seem to fall asleep just before it happens. We're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Jonathan on the line. Hey, Jonathan, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I was wanting to know if you could make any suggestions about how to use, and I'm not sure if I can say the word right. I think it's gochujang. At least that's how somebody at a Korean market told me to say it, which is the spicy red bean paste that they use.
Oh, boy. Okay, here, truth time.
Uh-huh.
I know squat about Korean food.
That's the thing. It doesn't seem like many people do.
I say I know nothing about it, but I've had some experience eating it, as probably you have, right?
I guess, yeah, like at the Korean restaurants, it seems like they must use it in some of the little pickled things.
You said the paste is red pepper, right?
It's red pepper and soybean.
Wait a minute. I think I do know what you're talking about, but
yeah.
I'm not sure about how. There's a book that came out about a year ago, I think.
Uh-huh.
And I think this was mentioned in it. It's a red pepper sauce. And I think it's the kind of thing that you're right, it probably is used in vegetables and pickles. But anything that has a lot of spice to it is wonderful rubbed on meat or fish before you grill.
Yeah.
But the book is something like growing up in Korea or growing up in a Korean kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you want to know how to use it. I can't give you an authentic way of using it.
Well, I mean, who needs that?
Well, it would be fascinating to know. But as we're talking about it, something occurs to me. There's something that I do with cabbage that, because I'm always trying to lose weight and it's just delicious at room temperature or hot, I chop up a big organic cabbage. I take a big pot of boiling salted water. I drop the cabbage in there and I boil it 8 or 10 minutes until it's tender. I drain it, and I toss it with vinegar and black pepper. And it is just so good, especially these organic cabbages at this time of year have a sweet undertone to them.
Uh-huh.
I would bet you if you tossed the cabbage with some of this sauce and a little bit of rice vinegar, it would be killer. And you could serve it at room temperature. You could eat it, you know, hot. You could probably put it in the fridge, and it would eventually pickle a little bit, you know, over a week or so.
Right, it'd be perfect just with plain white rice.
With plain white rice. You could also do the same thing with green beans. You could do the same thing with bok choy. You could do it with, you know, snow peas. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think because if it's a hot red pepper paste with maybe an interesting undertaste of more flavors, use it on really simple vegetables and let it shine through. Or if you're a meat eater, short ribs are the big thing in Korean food, where they're cooked and they're grilled eventually. And I'd say rub it over the short ribs, let them sit in the fridge overnight, and then bake them. I think it's got to be good.
All right.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Korean food. I really think it's the coming thing, guys. Call us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Teo calling. So, Teo, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, large pearl tapioca. I was actually given some from a friend who doesn't know how to make it, and we got a recipe from a family friend of my husband's. We've both tried it, and it just isn't working.
Now, okay, you're talking large pearl tapioca.
Not minute tapioca, the
okay.
Gusto kind.
Right, and what's not working?
We're doing the double boiler, the milk, you know, scalding everything, and when it's done, it's mush.
Okay, now for everybody who's not familiar with this, tapioca is essentially, it thickens, it gets very firm, it's like a pudding. Do you know, by the way, talk about extraneous information people carry around in their heads, do you know where tapioca comes from?
Is it from a root?
Oh, see, you know that. I thought I was the only one who knew that.
Is it taro root?
No, it's taro or cassava. I think they're the same plant.
Oh.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think they are. Yeah, okay. You know what the problem is? I remember hearing that if your pearl tapioca is old, it may not thicken. Now this is the method I think I used a long time ago.
Okay.
You soak it. You do like a half a cup of the pearl tapioca, which looks like little or big pearls, depending on. Yeah. And you stick a half a cup to about 2 cups of water.
Okay.
Put it in the fridge overnight. And then you add to that whatever flavorings you want and sweetening if you want it.
Okay.
And you simmer it, constantly stirring it, for 15 to 25 minutes, and it should thicken. But if it's old, it won't. And you have to go through all of that nonsense to find out if it's old.
Interesting.
Have you been soaking yours?
No.
See, the secret of life may be soaking anything that we're not sure about. That's So, you know what? It may be that the stuff is old, but why don't you give it one more shot? Let it soak overnight and then try. And by the way, I don't remember using a double boiler. I just did a real gentle simmer.
Okay, so a half a cup of tapioca to 2 cups of water, freeze it overnight.
Not freeze it, soak it.
Soak it, I'm sorry.
Yeah, chilled overnight. And then add whatever flavorings you want and cook it, you know, stir it so it doesn't stick, about 15 to 20 minutes at a gentle simmer and see if it thickens. And if it doesn't, you've got an old batch.
Do you have any suggestions for flavorings? I know vanilla. My mother used to put nutmeg in.
You know, I remember a long time ago, it's not this season, but rhubarb was really wonderful, sort
Ooh.
Of a sour sweet. And the other thing that might be really interesting is to add maybe, I'm just trying to think, something tart and sweet. I keep wanting to think about something we used to call Danish dessert that had cherries in it, and I think it had boysenberries. What I would do is maybe add something like dried sour cherries to it.
Oh.
Toward the end of cooking. Wouldn't that be nice?
That sounds wonderful.
With vanilla and sugar, I think that would really be nice.
Well, that's how we're going to do it.
Okay. I'm glad to see somebody else carries this extraneous info around in their brains.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome. Take care.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us with extraneous information or not. It can be pertinent if you'd like. 800-537-5252. We have Tracy calling. So, Tracy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have recently, and my wife, gotten heavily into grilling and smoking different meats, and we'd like to actually get into fish as well.
Right.
What I am unsure of is, particularly with smoking, the times that it needs to remain on the heat, depending
yeah.
on the size or the amount of the meat or... I'm just uncertain of the specifics with that.
Well, I think, you know, it really depends on the thickness and the degree of doneness that you want with what you are smoking. Now, do you have a smoker?
I have a charcoal smoker. I have a very nice grill that says it has smoking capabilities, But it's not. It doesn't seem to be the same. It's more of an indirect cooking method,
well,
where you add smoking, like a box, a smoker box with chips in it.
Oh, I see what you mean. Does it come with any directions at all, in terms of timing?
Not the grill. No, the smoker was a gift, and so it didn't have anything either. I didn't purchase it new. So
yeah, I know. It's a problem. You find these great bargains or whatever, and you don't get the instructions. But this is the thing. I have to confess to you, I have not done a heck of a lot of smoking. But when you're doing things with those charcoal smokers, you know, where you're actually putting the raw food in the smoker, they usually look like tall drums with a dome top.
That's right.
Usually, what you're doing there is you're cooking by heat, all right? And you're cooking by heat that's generally relatively low heat.
That's right.
Slow cooking.
Right.
And the trick to that is you want to make sure it's done. And that means, number one, you need an instant reading thermometer. And Taylor makes good ones. Taylor or Cuisinart are two good brands. This is a thermometer you stick into the meat, and within seconds you get a read of what the internal temperature is. You don't leave it in the meat because it doesn't stand a lot of heat. But when you check, you take seconds. The second thing is, for argument's sake, if you go to a cookbook and a cookbook says cook a loin of pork at about 15 minutes to a pound at 350, you would figure that your smoker has a lower temperature. It's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 300. So you would want to cook it 20 to 25 minutes to the pound. Do you follow my reasoning?
Because it's not going to heat as well.
It's not as intense heat.
Okay.
So what, and by the way, I don't think it's smart to try to smoke really thick things.
Uh-huh.
I would butterfly them or whatever, because I just think the smoke permeates more and it cooks a little bit faster.
Right.
So I would stick another 20 to 30% of cooking time on anything that you're putting into that charcoal smoker.
Okay.
You follow me?
I do.
Now, if you're doing it just in a standard, like a Weber kettle, and you're just going to throw chips in so that that creates smoke,
right?
And you're roasting by, as you said, indirect heat, then I'd just do what you normally do, because that's normal cooking where you're adding the smoke element by adding soaked woods,
right,
or other ingredients. Some people I know put pineapple rinds and things like, which by the way is quite sexy.
I've yet to really get any results from the indirect cooking as far as the advantage or the taste or the flavor of the smoke.
Yeah.
Even though it's indirect, there's still a large quantity of heat and it cooks rather quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And you can slow that down by just using less heat. You know, and just work that much slower and just keep adding the smoking material, and then you'll get that intense flavor.
Think about that, yeah.
Yeah, think about that. Okay.
Hey,
thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Enjoy your show.
Hey, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care. I've got a story for you. Where else but in Brooklyn, New York, would you find a British chef trained in classical French cuisine opening a fish and chip shop where he's making his fortune selling deep fried Twinkies? The chef is Chris Sell, and he's on the phone. Hey, Chris, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing swell. Look, now, you come from a fish and chip heritage, so how did you get to frying a Twinkie?
Actually, I come from a classically French-trained chef heritage. I opened a fish and chip shop, and one day we cook an awful lot of fish, and we got a little tired of it. So we went across the street and we bought like $10 worth of different candies and pastries, and the Twinkies really worked out well.
What is it about a Twinkie that makes it so good fried?
Well, it brings it back to life. It's like, you know, when you're a kid and you grab a bit of fresh cake off the side of the counter your mum's just made.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. It's almost like a freshly baked cake. It's warm, it's delicious, it's very moist. It just brings it all back to life.
Do you batter it, or just...
We do. We batter it in quite a salty batter, and so it's got the salt and the sweet thing going.
Well, now I want to back up. How did a French chef end up coming to run a fish and chip shop?
I missed one. It's purely selfish reasons. I moved to New York 13 years ago, and every time I went home, I had at least 3 or 4 fish and chip meals. And I was looking for a business, or looking to start a restaurant of some sort, and I couldn't make up my mind what sort of restaurant I wanted to open. And then it suddenly came to me, selfishly, fish and chips. And that's why I came to open the chip shop.
Well, I would imagine, considering how much we all love fried foods, that people have flocked.
Yeah, we've been very lucky. We won the best fish and chips from Time Out and the Village Voice and the best takeout from City Search. So we've been very fortunate with the response we've had from the local neighborhood and New York as a whole.
Well, what else did you experiment with when you were experimenting with the Twinkies? What else did you try out?
Well, on our menu, we have Twixes and Snickers bars and Mars bars and Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. And they're the standard everyday things. And the things that didn't work out were things like M&Ms. Apart from being very fiddly to fry individually, they just disappear to the bottom of our industrial fryer, never to be seen again.
There's now chocolate coating at the bottom of the fryer, right?
Yeah, you start getting, like, bits of fish coming up with, like, a bit of a green dye on it. It's very weird.
Well, we will stay tuned to see what's coming next. Chris, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Chris Sell is chef and owner of the Park Slope Chip Shop. It was named the best fish and chip shop in New York by Time Out New York City magazine. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Fran Lebowitz. Ask your child what he wants for dinner only when he is buying. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here and much more can be found on the website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. Oh, and don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.